In spite of her failure, patiently to wait upon God's good pleasure and to leave her welfare in his hands, Israel was given the bread from heaven. The word came from the mouth of the Lord, and her needs were supplied by miracle. She learned then that man lived not only by ordinary bread, produce of the earth. The word from the mouth of the Lord could, by its power, produce food where it was ordinarily not to be found. But the miracle was not worked because of Israel's confidence in God, rather, in spite of her lack of confidence. Jesus, on the contrary, puts himself completely into the hands of the Father, who can supply his needs when and as he wishes. Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word which proceeds from the mouth of God. Jesus will not be one who works miracles to relieve his own needs. He will not be Messiah of any other type than that which the Father wishes, the obedient servant of the Lord. The second temptation, which Jesus answers in words taken from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 16, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test," corresponds to the experience of Israel related in the book of Exodus, chapter 17, verses 1 through 7. From the desert of sin, the whole Israelite community journeyed by stages, as the Lord directed, and camped at Rephidim. Here there was no water for the people to drink. They quarreled therefore with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to a test?" Here then, in their thirst for water, the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "Why did you ever make us leave Egypt? Was it just to have us die here of thirst?" Again we see the same repudiation of their destiny, and again the grumbling. They demand water in the desert. That was their testing of the Lord. Now, as in the case of the manna, the miracle was worked. Moses struck a rock, and out of it water gushed. But again the miracle was worked in spite of the lack of confidence which Israel had shown. "You must not put the Lord your God to the test." It was with those words of Moses, warning Israel that it must not repeat this demand for a visible sign of God's presence among them and his care for them, that Jesus answered the temptation of the devil that he throw himself down from the pinnacle of the temple, because God would see that in doing so he would come to no harm. One can imagine what the working of such a useless miracle as that would have done for the popularity of Jesus. Yet he refuses to ask it. He is not meant to achieve belief in himself in that way. Israel had demanded a miracle. Jesus refuses to do so. "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test." Again he shows himself the obedient son, the opposite of disobedient Israel. The answer to the third temptation, that Jesus worshiped Satan in return for being given power over all the kingdoms of the world, is taken from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 13. "The Lord your God shall you adore, and him only shall you worship." A warning given to the people of Israel by Moses that after they had come into the promised land, they must remain faithful to the Lord and not worship the pagan gods. The subsequent history shows how badly they failed to observe that command. At first it may not appear what relation exists between Israel's temptation to worship foreign gods and the devil's suggestion to Jesus that he fall down and worship him. Perhaps we shall be helped to see the relation if we consider the advice which Paul gave to the Christians of Corinth on the matter of worship of idols. Of course, he tells them, we know that idols are really nothing. And yet they are not entirely nothing, for behind the idol there is a demonic reality. So to partake in the sacrificial banquets of idol worship is really to enter into communion with demons. Against the background of that thought expressed by Paul, but surely not peculiar to him, we can understand why Jesus responds to Satan's invitation to worship him in words which are taken from Moses' injunction that the Israelites should not worship pagan gods. For the worship of pagan gods is really the worship of Satan. What reward does Satan offer Jesus if he worship him? Power over all the kingdoms of the world. Here is false messianism at its crudest. We find in the statement of the risen Christ given in Matthew chapter 28, verse 18, "All power has been given to me in heaven and on earth," the contrast to the power which Satan offered Jesus at the beginning of his ministry. The contrast consists in this, that whereas Satan offered Jesus power over all the kingdoms if he would be false to his destiny and worship him, the Father gives him power in heaven and on earth because he has been true to his mission and has obediently accepted suffering and death. The power which he is destined to have comes to him only after he has fulfilled the role of the suffering servant of the Lord. And in utter dependence on the Father's will, Jesus repudiates Satan's offer. "The Lord your God shall you adore, and him alone shall you worship." Then the devil left him, and angels came and waited on him. We come finally to the question, where did this temptation account with its profound symbolism come from? Should we say that here, as in the baptism account, we are dealing with a single historical event which took place at the beginning of Jesus' public life? Or is it rather that knowing that Christ was subjected not once but many times to the temptation to be something different from what God wished, the early Christians formed an account giving a global picture of all those temptings of Jesus and presented them as something which took place at the beginning of his ministry? Perhaps there is no way of coming to a certain answer, but I think the latter alternative is the more probable. Why? Well, in the first place, there is a curious statement in St. Luke's Gospel, chapter 22, verse 28, which points in that direction. The scene is the Last Supper. Jesus is speaking to his disciples of the kingdom which he will give them. And he says to them, "You are the ones who have remained with me in my temptations." I think that that would be one indication that Jesus was tempted many times. And what is more likely than that his temptation would have been on that most important subject, the way, namely, in which he was to fulfill his mission in accordance with the will of the Father. A further indication. We have, both in Matthew and in Mark, Jesus' response to Peter after the first prediction of the Passion. And in that response, we have a form of address which is plainly connected with the temptation account, however we are to interpret the connection. After Peter tells Jesus that he should not even think of suffering, Jesus rebukes Peter, and in doing so he uses the same words which in both the Matthean and Lucan accounts are attributed to Jesus' rebuke of Satan, "Depart from me, Satan." Now, should we say that what Jesus had said to Satan at the beginning of his ministry, he also said to Peter on this occasion? Or rather, which I think more likely, that when the account of the temptation of Jesus was being formulated, the words of rebuke given by Jesus to Peter at the time when Peter attempted to make him unfaithful to the will of the Father that he should undergo suffering and death, were used to construct Jesus' response to Satan, because it was understood that what Peter had suggested to Jesus was really a diabolical thing. At all events, however we answer these questions, the message of the temptation account is not affected. And I should like, in closing, to quote some words of one who has written very well on this subject, and who, in these few words, has summed up, I think, all that can be said about the spiritual depth of the temptation story. This page of the Gospel is principally a theological document. It is less a biographical teaching than a teaching about the way in which Jesus understood his messianic role. The fundamental meaning of the account is to show that Jesus did not wish to be the Messiah of popular conceptions. He remained faithful to the mission which God had given him, in spite of the attractions of the ideas of political messianism in which he recognized the temptations of Satan. Thus, the account is a real theological summit in the Gospels, a condensation of Christian messianism.